Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Instagram propose des outils pour la famille qui permettent à vos proches de naviguer de façon raisonnable et en toute sécurité sur l'application. Quand les ados créent leur profil Instagram, les comptes privés par défaut garantissent que ce qu'ils publient n'est visible que par eux et les personnes qui les suivent. Choisir une limite quotidienne de temps aide votre ado à naviguer de façon raisonnable sur Instagram. Et paramétrer les outils de supervision ensemble vous offre une meilleure visibilité des comptes suivis par votre ado. Pour en savoir plus sur ces outils et en découvrir d'autres, rendez-vous sur instagram.com/outils pour la famille.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 14 hours GMT on Monday, the 27th of November. Pressure mounts on Israel and Hamas to extend their temporary truce in Gaza. Environmental activists say they're shocked at claims the UAE has used its role as host of UN climate talks to discuss oil and gas deals. And six former pupils at a school in France go on trial over the beheading of a teacher. Also in the podcast, Chinese families seek compensation nearly a decade after the disappearance of flight MH370.
After 10 years, the court has finally opened the hearing. I hope that the legal relief can be realised as soon as possible.
And New Zealand's new centre-right government scraps the country's smoking ban. The four-day truce between Israel and Hamas is reportedly due to end at 7 a.m. local time tomorrow, but both sides say they are willing to extend it. The fourth and final hostage and prisoner swap of the original deal is due today, though there have been reports of minor issues over who will be included. If the exchange does go ahead, it will mean that 50 Israeli hostages will have been released over 4 days in return for 150 Palestinian prisoners, all women and children. Hamas also released a number of foreign workers. Speaking in Spain, the Palestinian Foreign Minister, Riyad al-Maliki, said there is broad support for a continuation of the ceasefire agreement.
The Qataris, the Egyptians, the United States, the European Union, Spain, Palestine, we're all working to extend that truce by 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. The most important thing is to continue extending the truce, because that means stopping the killing.
But the Israeli government spokesman, Alon Levy, said at a news conference in Tel Aviv that depended on Hamas freeing more hostages.
The framework remains in place for the release of more hostages after tonight's batch, providing an additional 1 day of hostage release pause for every 10 additional hostages who are released. When Hamas stops releasing hostages under the existing framework, Israel will return to realizing our three goals with full force: eliminating Hamas, ensuring that Gaza never again poses a threat to the people of Israel, and of course, releasing all of our hostages.
Well, our Middle East affairs analyst Sebastian Usher told me there was still some uncertainty over the latest prisoner swap.
The Israeli Prime Minister's office has just released a statement saying that the negotiations over the list of this fourth group of hostages is continuing, and saying that the office is aware of the stress that the families involved are under, and that information will be added when it becomes possible, and also makes a plea to avoid spreading rumours and unreliable information. I mean, it's unclear exactly what the sticking point is, but it seems from the Israeli side that it may be to do with separation of families of hostages, that some people are being released while other members of their families remain behind with Hamas in Gaza. And from the other perspective, the Hamas side, they have issues over the latest list of prisoners who are due to be released by Israel. We've seen over the past 3 days, on the first 2 days, it was mainly women prisoners and boys and teenagers under 19 being freed. Yesterday, it was almost all teenage boys. So it looks as if the number of women that are left to be released by Israel is almost at its end, and that there's some dispute, some discussion over the standing of the prisoners who will be released. Now, Hamas obviously wants more significant prisoners to be released, if possible, during this round.
Yeah, I mean, we saw some delays on Saturday, which were eventually resolved. But let's look at the bigger issue, the chances of an extension. I see that Egyptian, Qatari and US negotiators are reported to be close to agreeing a continuation of the truce. But then we have heard those kind of things before. What do you make of it all?
I mean, we have. I mean, this particular report is sourced on three Egyptian unnamed security sources. I mean, the Egyptians have been very much involved in mediation, but we have had, as you've said, some misinformation that has come out from various sources. So we need to be cautious about this. But there's no doubt that the international pressure on Israel, in particular from its allies, is growing for the extension. We've heard it from President Biden. We've heard it from other senior US officials. We've heard it today from the head of NATO. All essentially united in saying that they want to see the ceasefire extended at least to some extent. I mean, what you were hearing there from the Israeli spokesman, Elon Levy, was the Israeli stance that they accept an extension if it's done on a day-by-day basis and as long as Hamas continues to release 10 hostages a day. From Hamas' perspective, what we understand is that they want a longer extension agreed from the start, another four-day extension. So obviously there'd been major issues over that. But I mean, my feeling is that an extension is more likely than not at the moment. Right.
Sebastian Usher. So US, NATO and EU officials are all hopeful that an extension to the truce can be reached. And leaders in the Arab world are watching closely too, as our security correspondent Frank Gardner told Michelle Hussein.
Every country in the Middle East, apart from Israel, would like this truce to become a permanent ceasefire. Leaders in the region, ministers, people I've spoken to are very concerned that if the war continues, it could actually radicalise a lot of populations in the region because people are watching it live on their televisions and they're appalled by it. Israel's view is that if Hamas is allowed to retain a military capacity, it will simply repeat what it did on October the 7th. But in the meantime, there are still 180 hostages, roughly, that are left in Gaza. There is a possibility of being able to get more out and stay off Israel's resumption of the war, probably for about two, three, maybe four more days. After that, it looks like Israel is determined to continue this war.
And would Hamas also keep some hostages? I mean, that in the terrible dynamics of this, that is its leverage.
Yeah, I mean, the hardest negotiations, Michelle, are going to come over the military hostages that Hamas seized. The members of the Israel Defense Forces, both men and women, they will almost certainly demand a very high price for them. In other words, a large number of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails, much larger than we've seen already. I think we kind of tend to overgeneralize that raid on October the 7th, we call it the Hamas raid, but it wasn't just Hamas. It was members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is another militant group there, and even private individuals, gangs, basically, that just went in and rampaged through southern Israel. And part of the problem now is that Hamas is saying, look, we need more time because they've got to try and find these hostages that are hidden with other people in Gaza.
Frank Gardner. Well, whatever happens with the truce, the people of Gaza are suffering the effects of 7 weeks of Israeli bombardment launched after the Hamas atrocities of the 7th of October. The BBC's Justin Webb has been talking to James Elder from UNICEF, who is currently in northern Gaza.
The whole place and the people, they just bear the marks of immense distress, of trauma, street after street, reduced to rubble, children with the most horrendous wounds of war, both inside the hospital and emergency wards, but makeshift emergency wards, outside in a car park, outside in the garden. And this, of course, is during a humanitarian pause.
And a pause that may not last beyond tonight.
Exactly. This is what we quite frequently hear. And that, of course, would just have utterly disastrous consequences for people here, as ever, with children bearing the brunt. When a bomb or a mortar hits an apartment block, Justin, and a child is there, they get multiple injuries. It's broken bones. It's also shrapnel, of course, blast, which is often to the eyes. And then, of course, horrendous burns, just children after children with this. I've never seen the scale before.
So what would you say to Hamas? Because, of course, it could continue if they let out more hostages. What is the UN saying to Hamas?
UNICEF has said from day one, release these children. The torment that their parents must feel, the wider family, is beyond the pale. So it's magnificent news that some, not enough, not all, have been released. It's terrific to bring back children who've been detained in Israel. But again, when we can talk of these things, we talk of hostages and children detained, or we talk of the many thousands who have been killed, and apparently the world is happy to watch that number added to. It just underlines this is a war on children. I defer to someone who's here, a Palestinian woman I spoke to yesterday, Justin, a hospital administrator in her 70s. And she talked to me about what she's been enduring, living in a church with 100 people and so on. And she simply said, it seems to me, James, that my final days will be in hell. But what about the children?
James Elder from UNICEF talking to us from Gaza. The choice of the United Arab Emirates as host for COP28, this year's UN climate talks, has been controversial from the start. Now, leaked documents obtained by the BBC suggest that the UAE planned to use its role as an opportunity to discuss oil deals. Environmental activists say the allegations, if true, are a scandal. The UAE's team didn't deny using COP meetings for business talks, but said they were fully focused on, quote, meaningful climate action. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has this report.
And now, more than ever, we need to unite on climate and deliver a clear message of hope.
Dr. Sultan Al Jaber, appointed the president of COP28 by the UAE, was building ambition at a meeting of environment ministers from around the world last month.
And we must deliver in Dubai.
But Mr. Jaber is also the head of ADNOC, the UAE's huge state oil company, and its renewable energy business, Masdar. Now, working alongside independent journalists at the Centre for Climate Reporting, we've got hold of briefing documents prepared by the UAE's COP28 team ahead of meetings with 27 foreign governments. They show Dr. Jaber was briefed to discuss business deals for the state firms. Now, I've got the documents here, and they suggest telling China that the UAE's oil company is willing to jointly evaluate liquefied natural gas opportunities in Mozambique, Canada, and Australia. The Brazilian environment minister was to be asked to help with the UAE's multi-billion dollar bid for a Brazilian oil and gas processing company. Now, attempting to do business deals, especially oil and gas deals, during the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards the UN expects of a COP president. It told the BBC a president should be impartial and act without bias or self-interest. Professor Michael Jacobs of Sheffield University is an expert on UN climate politics.
This looks breathtakingly hypocritical, but I actually think it's worse than that, because the UAE at the moment is the custodian of a United Nations process aimed at reducing global emissions. And yet, in the very same meetings, it's actually trying to do side deals which will increase global emissions.
The ADNOC HQ, 65 stories high, dominates the skyline of Abu Dhabi. We know on at least one occasion a country followed up on a potential fossil fuel deal brought up in a meeting arranged by the UAE's COP28 team. But 12 countries have told the BBC there was either no discussion of commercial activities during meetings or a meeting did not take place.
I think what's really exciting about this is that he's a CEO and he brings that CEO mentality.
I questioned the Director General of the UAE's COP28 team, Majid Al Suwaidi, at a press conference in Abu Dhabi last month.
Mr. Majid, as you know, there is some anxiety about an oil executive being put in charge of a climate conference. What would you say to reassure people of the independence of COP28 from ADNOC?
Our team is fully independent. We are very confident that our team is focused on delivering COP28, is focused on delivering the great results that we need to do.
The COP28 team did not deny using climate meetings to discuss fossil fuel deals. It told the BBC, private meetings are private and we do not comment on them.
I am Manuel Pulgar Vidal.
This former COP president is worried a collapse in trust could mean no progress on tackling climate change in Dubai.
the president of the COP, it is the leader of the world. It is trying to build consensus on behalf of the planet. If any president of the COP try to bring a particular interest, that it could be one country or one commercial interest, that immediately could mean a failure of that COP.
The former COP president, Manuel Pulgar Vidal, ending that report by Justin Rolat. And still to come on the Global News podcast.
There's a battle online to control the narrative, to influence opinions on losses and suffering, rights and wrongs, facts and fake news.
How the Israel-Gaza war is being fought on social media. Power cuts have become a frequent problem in Ukraine since Russia's invasion, with airstrikes and other attacks damaging energy infrastructure. But now nature is making matters worse after a major storm left 2 million people without electricity, including in Russian-occupied Crimea. Heavy snow has blocked roads and flooding has forced people from their homes. While in the south of Ukraine, winds of up to 160 kilometres an hour were reported. I spoke to our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse.
Here in Kyiv, there were definitely high winds. It's been especially cold. And from the capital, it's almost bittersweet because the high winds make the chances of drone strikes by Russia a little bit less likely because their desired targets might be harder to hit. But as you say, this is a cruel hand from nature, if you like, where we've seen reports of widespread reports of hypothermia. We've seen emergency crews towing countless vehicles from the snow. It's around the sort of southern Odessa and Mykolaiv regions where difficulties are being most acutely felt. But of course, we're talking about Russian-occupied territory too. Many will remember the city of Mariupol, which was laid brutally to siege last year. There have been damaged buildings there. And in Crimea itself, Moscow-installed officials are declaring a state of emergency. They've been evacuating people after coastal flooding, as well as a river bursting its banks. So it's an incredibly desperate situation. And of course, we're talking about all of these civilian implications, but of course it makes the front line all the more desperate as well for the soldiers fighting the fight.
Yeah, and for both civilians and soldiers, it's obviously the last thing they want after 21 months of conflict.
Absolutely. And I think this time last year, cities like Kyiv were getting pummeled with Russian missiles and drones as Moscow embarked on this strategy of trying to target infrastructure. And I think there's been a bit of a muscle memory this time around, where as winter starts to bite, and it bites quickly in this part of the world, many were fearing that Russia would resume its tactic again. We had a weekend where Kyiv faced more drones than since the start of the full-scale invasion. Air defences have improved drastically, but of course not everything is in Ukraine's control, as we've seen today and overnight.
Our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse. In October 2020, France was shocked by the beheading of a teacher called Samuel Paty after he showed his class caricatures of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. The attacker, an 18-year-old Chechen refugee, was shot dead by police near the school in a Paris suburb. Six teenagers, who were pupils at the time of the killing, have now gone on trial over their actions in the lead-up to the murder. Our Paris correspondent Hugh Schofield told me more about the accused.
We can split them into two groups, a group of five and one other. The five are accused of identifying Samuel Paty to the killer, Alekh Anzorov, on the afternoon when he came to the school. He decided that he wanted to wreak vengeance on Samuel Paty for allegedly having shown these caricatures, but he didn't know who he was. He didn't know what he looked like. So he needed the help of a pupil or pupils, and he approached one with some money. That pupil took the money and then shared it with some friends, and they did what they were asked to do and identified the teacher. The other pupil is a girl whose lie at the beginning of all this started the terrible train of events, because she'd told her father wrongly that she'd been in the class where the cartoon was shown. In fact, she hadn't been in that class at all. She'd been suspended because of misbehaviour, and she made an excuse to her father by saying, oh, I was kicked out of this, I protested in this class about the showing of the cartoon. It was a lie. But her father got very angry and then started the online campaign against the teacher, which then made its way to the killer, Abdullah Kanzarov.
Yeah, I mean, a terrible tragedy spiralling out of the actions of these youngsters.
Indeed. And I mean, their defence clearly is going to be that we couldn't possibly have known what was going to happen. And I dare say that'll be taken into account. And the five who are accused of identifying Patty aren't accused of assistance in a murder. They're accused of complicity in an act of violence, because it's accepted they couldn't possibly have known that Anzorov was going to kill Samuel Patty. Nonetheless, you know, they are charged with helping the killer en route and for not thinking about their actions. And they stand to serve some months in prison, though it may well be that they get off just with a very, very stern, you know, conviction, but a stern warning.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Almost 10 years after Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 disappeared en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board, a court in the Chinese capital has begun to hear compensation claims. The plane is presumed to have plunged into the Southern Ocean south of India. After the largest search in aviation history, only a few pieces of debris were ever located. Families of the mainly Chinese victims gathered outside the court. Zhang Hui's mother was one of those on the flight.
After 10 years, the court has finally opened the hearing. To us, it's a turning point. But the survival of the relatives during these years, the deterioration of their living conditions, with many relatives having left us because they didn't have money to treat illnesses, this makes us very sad. So I hope that the legal relief can be realised as soon as possible. It's not difficult.
Our China correspondent Laura Bicker told me more about the case.
As you heard there, I think the hope is that more than 40 families who've filed lawsuits against Malaysia Airlines, the aircraft manufacturer Boeing, engine maker Rolls-Royce and Alliance Insurance Group, they're looking for some kind of closure. And the hope is that they get some compensation for, as you heard there, a disaster that deprived them of their loved ones and placed them in financial difficulty. Now, this disaster resonated through Beijing. Just after the disappearance of the flight, there were daily briefings, there were daily vigils. Some relatives refused to believe the plane had disappeared, believing it had been taken to an unknown site. Others thought their relatives remained alive and refused to accept compassionate payments from the airline. Now, even if the court rules in their favour, it's not really clear what financial obligations each of these organisations, whether it be Malaysia Airlines, Boeing, Rolls-Royce or Alliance, may have. And so far, no charges have been brought against the flight crew. So the family's litigation request focuses on this compensation, but also about trying to find the truth behind this flight's disappearance. The case appears to be based on the contention that the airline failed to take measures to locate the plane after it disappeared from air traffic control about 38 minutes after takeoff over the South China Sea on that night, March the 8th, 2014.
And has the Chinese government got any view on this case?
Well, China says it values the follow-up to the incident of MH370 and Malaysia Airlines flights that went missing and hopes all sides maintain close communication and properly handle this issue. That was from the Foreign Ministry earlier today, from spokesperson Wang Wenbin. He made the comments after media reports of the court holding these first hearings of the lawsuit became public. Malaysia's transport minister and Malaysian Airlines have both declined to comment on the hearings so far. And there has been some criticism that this court hearing has been shrouded in secrecy. But as you heard there, families have been managing to speak to reporters as they head into the hearings.
Our China correspondent Laura Bicker in Beijing. Now, it's been described as a huge win for the tobacco industry. The new right of centre government in New Zealand has announced it will scrap plans for anti-smoking laws due to have come in later this year. The move was confirmed by the new Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, after he was sworn in and is part of a wider rollback of the previous government's policies. I heard more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
These are laws introduced into New Zealand last year, and they would have banned cigarette sales next year to anyone born after 2008. And this was an attempt to ban smoking for future generations. At the time, medical practitioners and anti-tobacco campaigners said that the measures would save thousands of lives. And what we're seeing now, one of the first acts of the new centre-right coalition government in New Zealand, is to scrap the legislation to fund tax cuts that were part of its election campaign. So a lot of controversy on day one of the new government in New Zealand.
Yeah, tell us what else they're planning. They want to roll back the use of the Maori language and end a ban on oil and gas exploration.
That's right. The government under the new Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, says there will be a reappraisal of measures to boost the Maori language in New Zealand and also a repeal of a ban on offshore oil and gas exploration. And there will be many people in New Zealand who are now getting used to the idea that a new government means a whole load of new reforms, given that Labour under the former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was in power for 6 years. And now we have a Conservative coalition administration that seems likely to take a bit of an axe to the policies of the former administration.
Yeah, it's quite a turnaround. Jacinda Ardern was quite popular around the world, perhaps less so among some in New Zealand. But overall, the country seems to have shifted to the right.
Jacinda Ardern quit earlier this year. She was replaced by a man called Chris Hipkins, who led the Labour Party into the election in the middle of October. There was a crushing defeat for Labour, and it has resulted in 6 weeks of negotiations between the Conservative National Party and two smaller minor parties. And what we have now is a coalition of the National Party and also the Libertarian Act New Zealand Party and the populist New Zealand First Party. And it's the New Zealand First part of the coalition that was very keen, for example, to repeal these tough anti-tobacco measures. And it could well be for many New Zealanders a taste of what's to come, the unwinding of various reforms introduced by the Ardern government. And for many New Zealanders, they wanted a change, and change they most certainly have, going from 6 years of a left of centre Labour government to at least 3 more years of a centre-right coalition.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. Returning now to the conflict in the Middle East. And ever since the Hamas atrocities of the 7th of October and the Israeli assault on Gaza, there has been a dramatic rise in divisive rhetoric and misinformation online. But with lives being lost in the real world, should we care what's happening on sites like TikTok and X, formerly Twitter? That's the question being asked in the first episode of The Global Story, a new BBC podcast launching today.
This war isn't only being fought on the ground. There's a battle online to control the narrative, to influence opinions on losses and suffering, rights and wrongs, facts and fake news. So we're asking, who is winning the social media war?
And asking the question, Global Story presenter Katja Adler, who joined me to tell us more about the social media war.
I think a lot is being made in the Israel-Hamas war, as at the time when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that we are going back to a time of conventional warfare, if you like. And that's shocking for a lot of countries that said, you know, those days were in the past. But at the same time as going back, we are going forward. And all of these wars, and if you remember in Syria as well, at the time, it was being fought out, played out on social media. We ignore that at our peril. And also, you can't tell the whole story without looking at social media. When it comes to Israel-Gaza right now, obviously, for a global audience, the images that are across social media of the terrible civilian suffering in Gaza, and also, of course, the massacre that was orchestrated by Hamas inside Israel, the taking of, you know, more than 200 hostages into the Gaza Strip, including very, very small children, it's very emotive. And that really plays out and resonates on social media. So on the one hand, I think you've got this ability to inform, and that's what we talk about. It can engage a much wider audience and get them involved in global issues and perhaps put pressure on governments to solve global issues. The negative side of it is it can be so emotive that it can divide and send people even further into their echo chambers. So, you know, it's multi-layered, and that's what we like on The Global Story, our multi-layers, and we try try and peel back those layers for you.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting that younger people were getting their views from TikTok, and they tended to be more, pro-Palestinian, whereas on X, Twitter, as it was, they're more pro-Israeli.
I think this is a snapshot that we see on our programme as to where it is now. You know, we talk to the BBC's disinformation expert, and that's what we do on The Global Story, is we really tap into all of those experts that we have at the BBC. And because we have a bit more time, we look at one global story at a time every day, Monday to Friday. It enables those experts to really showcase their knowledge, to really help us get under the skin of a story. And also what we want to do is send our listeners away with, oh, I hadn't thought of it that way. And that way we continue the conversation, because hopefully our listeners then have dinner with their family or go into work the next day going, oh, did you know this? And we continue that global conversation.
So episode one in the can. Do you know what you're going to be doing for the rest of the week?
We're going to do so much stuff. You have to tune in to find out. But we aim to cover a really broad range of stories. So we're obviously going to look at the environment, because you've got, the COP summit coming up. We have a look at Biden's brain. So Joe Biden, aging US president who's standing for re-election. Should he? What can we expect of 81, 82-year-olds? How come he gets away with it? And the man who we presume will be his rival for president in the US next year, Donald Trump, only 4 years younger, but he seems to escape a lot of that kind of ageist criticism. Very importantly, we have some tips for all of us then about how to keep all of our brains younger. So that's one of the other episodes. So we do really try to cover a whole range and, where appropriate, some humour.
Katya Adler, and you can find Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was produced by Peter Goffin and mixed by Vladimir Morzechka. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.